This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The presidential election is so close and there are so many lawyers around the country ready for action, it's conceivable that Tuesday's election will wind up in the courts. My guest, David Margalek, has investigated what happened 4 years ago in the Supreme Court when it decided to hear the Republicans' challenge to the recount in Florida. The U.S. Supreme Court stopped the Florida recount and ruled it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution because each Florida county was using a different standard for evaluating ambiguous votes. David Margalek is one of the three authors of a story in the October issue of Vanity Fair magazine titled The Path to Florida. Margalek is a contributing editor to the magazine and is the former national legal affairs editor and legal columnist for The New York Times. Margalek's chief sources for his Supreme Court story were people who were clerks of the justices in 2000. His pursuit of them and their willingness to talk with him have proven to be quite controversial. Several clerks spoke with you for this article. What is the typical understanding of a clerk's confidentiality in the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that the understanding is that clerks say nothing about what goes on at the court. Either when they're there or later, really in perpetuity. The understanding is that they never speak.
Under the Supreme Court's Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, they have to sign a confidentiality agreement.
Yes, this is something new. 10 or 15 years ago, a fellow named Eddie Lazarus, a former law clerk himself, wrote a book about his experiences at the court. And ever since then, all subsequent clerks have had to sign confidentiality agreements.
So the clerks who spoke with you broke that confidentiality agreement.
Well, you know, it depends on how much of a lawyer you want to be about this. Some of them would say that the confidentiality agreement covered only whatever proper activities the court engaged in. And since the court went overboard in this case, they didn't feel bound by it.
So the clerks told you that they felt that the court went overboard in this case, and that's why they didn't feel bound by the agreement?
Yes, that's right. The clerks who spoke to me felt that something illegitimate had happened in this case and that the court had delved into the political realm in an inappropriate way, and that weighing the pledge that they had made with their sort of larger obligations as citizens, it was more important, they felt, to speak out and to describe what happened at the court rather than let it wait for 15 or 20 years until some justice's papers were opened up. And I was grateful for that, and I appreciate it.
There's an open letter to Legal Times in the September 27th issue from 96 former law clerks and lawyers who practiced before the Supreme Court, and they called the clerks talking to you conduct unbecoming any attorney or legal advisor working in a position of trust. And are you troubled at all that they spoke to you, or do you think it's perfectly justified for the story that you got?
Well, I was delighted that they spoke to me, and I thought that they helped fill a black hole in American history, and I admired them for doing it. I thought they were very courageous to do it, because even though they did it anonymously, it's a very small network, and fingers would inevitably point at certain people. I think it's very easy for these 96 people, most of whom, incidentally, were on the right wing of the spectrum, to come down and condemn them. It was very easy and very predictable.
Three Republican senators had asked the Senate Judiciary Committee to consider hearings to determine whether there had been misconduct on the part of these Supreme Court clerks who spoke to you. What's happening with that?
As far as I know, nothing is happening. And again, that's not particularly surprising to me. I thought it was just really political posturing. I mean, they were three very right-wing senators, and I didn't take it seriously, and I didn't think that anything would happen as a result of it. I should say in response to your previous question, Terry, that, you know, it's very easy to say that under all circumstances, clerks should never speak to reporters. But we all know that, you know, we would have liked very much to have had a clerk's eye view of what happened at the court during some of its most egregious decisions, its segregation decision, the decision about the Japanese-American internment during World War II, the decisions upholding slavery. And I think that no one would say that under those circumstances it would have been inappropriate for a clerk to speak. And having decided that, then it clearly becomes a continuum over when it's appropriate and when it's not.
To refresh everyone's memories, a lot of experts thought that it was very unlikely that the Supreme Court would intervene in the Florida recount because traditionally that has been that voting has been in the state's domain. Can you elaborate on the reasons why many experts thought that the Supreme Court would not intervene?
Well, the court's authority is very fragile. And courts generally stay away from explicitly political cases. They stay away from cases that aren't ripe, that aren't fully adjudicated below. They generally defer to states and state courts. The court recognizes that it can't jump willy-nilly into every political controversy and that its authority is more delicate than that. And for that reason, I think that the clerks to whom I spoke and the justices for whom they worked were flabbergasted when the court agreed to hear the case.
What were the grounds that the Bush lawyers used in taking the recount to the Supreme Court?
They argued that the Florida Supreme Court had usurped the role of the legislature in determining what rules govern the selection of electors to the Electoral College. That was one of the arguments. And that they had created new law, that the Florida Supreme Court had created new law ex post facto, after the fact law, which was improper under the Constitution. They also argued, as a subsidiary matter, that the way in which the ballots were being recounted, since it varied from one jurisdiction to another, violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
So what else did you learn about the process of deciding whether the Supreme Court should actually hear the case?
Nobody expected the court to agree to hear the case. The court had dispersed for Thanksgiving. The justices had gone off in various directions. The clerks had made plans to celebrate with their families. And they really thought the court would never agree to hear it. Justice Breyer said, over Thanksgiving dinner to someone, that there was no way the court would agree to hear it. And they were just thunderstruck when five justices agreed. It only takes four, and five of them lined up very quickly. That's the first vote. The second vote, after the first oral argument, was unanimous, 9-0, to send it back to the Florida Supreme Court, and I think the justices felt unanimously, or almost unanimously, never to see it again, and therefore to spare the court an enormous institutional embarrassment of deciding a presidential election by a vote of 5-4. And they thought that by sending it back to the Florida Supreme Court the first time, that would effectively decide the matter. But the Florida Supreme Court confounded them and came back with a 4-3 decision, ordering the recount to continue and even expanding the recount. And so therefore, the case bounced back to the Supreme Court, and the schisms that the court had managed to paper over initially at that point were bound to come out.
So when the case came back to the Supreme Court, you write that the Gore lawyers assumed that Justices Kennedy and O'Connor were the two swing votes, and that what the lawyers had to do was convince Kennedy and O'Connor, or Kennedy or O'Connor, to go over to the Gore side. But you say O'Connor's mind, you learned in your reporting that O'Connor's mind was basically already made up.
Yes, O'Connor had said to her clerks very early that she wanted to find a way to stop the recount in Florida. And that the impression that I got from my interviews was that she was personally offended by what was going on in Florida and that she was determined to find a way to stop it. And the only question was finding the legal rationale for doing it.
Do you know what it was that offended her?
Well, I'm not an authority on Justice O'Connor, but I gather that she's sort of offended by any kind of disorder or messiness. And she just wanted, she was offended that Florida voters didn't seem to know how to punch a hole all the way through the ballot. And it seemed intuitively unfair to her that different standards were being used in different counties. And she thought that a kind of heist was going on, and she wanted to stop it.
And what about Justice Kennedy? What did you learn about how he made up his mind?
Well, the clerks focused a lot on Justice Kennedy. In fact, it's almost a little bit unfair to Justice Kennedy in the sense that the three of the justices, Rehnquist, Thomas, and Scalia, their votes were taken for granted. I mean, it was automatically assumed that among the clerks that come what may, they would vote to stop the recount. And they get a pass in a sense because no one was talking about them. Their votes were taken for granted. They were already considered to be lost, whereas O'Connor and Kennedy were the ones that got the most scrutiny because they were theoretically thought still to be in play. And Kennedy is the clerks focused on Kennedy in particular because they felt that he was in a way that they had spotted before and that he was renowned for in a sense. that he was posturing, that he was pretending to a kind of open-mindedness that he really didn't have, and that his mind was made up, but that he made a great public demonstration of agonizing so that he could say that afterwards.
My guest is David Margalek, one of the three authors of the article The Path to Florida, published in the October issue of Vanity Fair. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Margalek. For the Vanity Fair article The Path to Florida, he spoke with several people who clerked with Supreme Court justices in 2000 during the case Bush v. Gore. Now, you write about how Kennedy's law clerks were screened with the help of arch conservatives. Tell me what you learned about this.
Well, this is something that's been out there for some time, that Kennedy is thought to be an unreliable conservative by the right wing. He's deviated on several important cases, including abortion-related cases, and that there was great debate in cases of that kind over who lost Kennedy. And there's a whole sort of network of right-wing professors, judges, clerks, the Federalist Society, that kind of vowed not to ever let this happen again. And they took over Justice Kennedy's selection process for screening and picking law clerks. And they screened them precisely to avoid the possibility that a liberal law clerk would have any kind of untoward effect on Kennedy. The feeling was that in the abortion case, that a liberal law clerk, a former protege of the Harvard professor Lawrence Tribe, a famous liberal, might have helped lure Kennedy away from the pro-life side. And they vowed that it would never happen again. And so year after year, Kennedy's law clerks were the most undeviatingly conservative of any justice. And that was particularly true in the year of Bush v. Gore.
You know, it sounds kind of like devious when you describe it, but really this couldn't be happening without Kennedy's permission. So, it's not like his power is being usurped by conservatives.
No, that's right. As one of the clerks said to me, it's just, the whole assumption is that a Supreme Court justice is, unduly influenceable by a second-year lawyer. And it's a bizarre phenomenon. And surely, he knows what's going on. I think that it's a peculiar phenomenon at the court that many of the justices surround themselves with like-minded people. I mean, one would think that they'd be strong enough to have a diversity of opinion laid out before them, but in many instances, that's not true.
Now, you also write in your piece that Justice Stevens wanted out of this case altogether, and he wanted the political process in Florida to unfold, but Justice Scalia wanted to overturn the Florida Supreme Court and call the election for Bush. Can you describe what you learned about each of their positions?
Well, they seem to have been the polar extremes in this case. Justice Stevens was the most adamant and opinionated about keeping the court out of it altogether and feeling that the court was going to sully its reputation by getting involved in this in any way, and he drafted the most passionate dissent to that effect. He seems to have been the ringleader of the dissenters, really. And Justice Scalia was his opposite number on the other side of the spectrum. He felt that the recount was illegitimate from day one, and he wanted to stop it. And all of the other justices were really somewhere in between those two poles.
When the Supreme Court decided to stop the Florida recount, Justice Scalia wrote, "Count first and rule upon legality afterwards is not a recipe for producing election results that have the public acceptance democratic stability requires." The clerks who spoke to you, some of them said that they were amazed at how baldly Justice Scalia was pushing what they considered to be his own partisan agenda. What did they tell you?
Well, they told me that Scalia seemed hell-bent on stopping the recount as quickly as he possibly could. And that the fear seems to have been that Gore was going to go ahead, and he was so anxious to stop the recount that at one point Justice Stevens had to ask for extra time to complete his dissent. That's how much of a hurry Scalia was in.
What Scalia is saying in the part that I quoted is that if the court is going to rule on the legality of the vote, it's better not to count the vote first, because then if they decided that the recount was illegal, but the recount went to Gore, it would challenge the legitimacy of Bush. I mean, Did the other justices not think that he had a point there?
Well, I think that history has proven that the legitimacy of the Bush presidency, I think, suffered from the Supreme Court's decision rather than was enhanced by it. So that, you know, that Scalia's concern for legitimacy were not borne out. I mean, the Supreme Court didn't do Bush a favor by ruling in the way that it did. Bush may well have emerged as president from the political process that the founders had laid out. It would have been messy, no doubt, but that was the procedure, and no one would have faulted the Supreme Court for letting that procedure play out in the way that the founders envisioned.
One of the reasons that the Supreme Court gave for stopping the recount in Florida and the decision that ended up in Bush being declared the winner was that the recount was violating the Equal Protection Clause because different counties were counting in different ways, were evaluating the votes in different ways, so that voters were not equally represented. So this violated the Equal Protection Clause. But the first time the case came to the Supreme Court discounted that the Equal Protection Clause was relevant in their understanding of the case. Can you explain what counted for that contradiction?
Well, the clerks would have said that the court was fishing around for a rationale to base its decision, its sort of preordained decision. And equal protection, which was disparaged at the beginning, emerged as the only argument on which five of the justices could agree. And so as the case went on, the equal protection argument loomed larger and larger, even though it had been kind of disrespected at the outset. Justices O'Connor and Kennedy didn't sign on to the more structural argument that the other three justices in the majority supported about how the Florida legislature's authority had been usurped by the Florida Supreme Court. And the question is, why then did those two in particular find equal protection a more appealing argument? And I think that, you know, the explanation would be that there's a kind of intuitive appeal to the argument. I mean, one can easily argue that in the best of all possible worlds, all the counties in Florida would have followed the same procedure and judged the ballots in the same way. And there was a kind of intuitive unfairness to the different ways in which they did it in different jurisdictions. I mean, this is what Justice Breyer alluded to in his dissenting opinion. But what's important to note is that elections are riddled with those kinds of inconsistencies, you know, far more important inconsistencies, for instance, like the kinds of voting machines that were used and how the older voting machines that were used in poorer jurisdictions routinely threw out far more ballots than the newer voting machines in wealthier jurisdictions. And the court had never stepped into something like that before and had never declared that an equal protection violation. So to the clerks, it seemed as if they were reaching for a rationale, and they were applying a doctrine that had never been applied so profligately before in the election area. And it seemed just like a rationale to them, a stretch.
Now, you say that Justices Breyer and Souter thought that if the Equal Protection Clause was being violated, that if some of the justices believed that the solution was to send the case back to the Florida Supreme Court and insist that the Florida Supreme Court set an equal standard for all the counties who were participating in recounts. Did you learn anything about why that argument lost within the court?
Well, I think that the interesting thing is that the Florida Supreme Court was in a very tough bind. It couldn't stretch very far without the Republicans claiming that it was making new law. And so, therefore, it hadn't set this kind of standard. But this is what Justices Breyer and Souter were saying. Just give if equal protection is a problem, let's just give the Florida Supreme Court the chance to set a standard and we can take care of it. And the interesting thing about the argument was that they thought that since Kennedy and O'Connor, or Kennedy in particular, was going off on equal protection and was concerned about the perceived unfairness of the different standards in the various jurisdictions, that they might be able to peel him away from the majority. And they phrased their opinions accordingly. I mean, they tried to win him over by conceding his point and saying, yes, there is a fairness problem here, but it can be fixed. And they thought that in that way, they could move him from the other side to their side and keep the recount going. But it turns out to have been a kind of miscalculation because they almost conceded too much, and in their opinions were later construed to mean that they actually agreed that there was an equal protection violation rather than just a matter of unfairness, that it rose to constitutional dimensions. And the defenders of Bush v. Gore afterwards could say the decision was not really a 5-4 decision, but a 7-2 decision.
David Margalek is one of the authors of the article The Path to Florida, published in the October issue of Vanity Fair. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Margalek. He's one of the three authors of the article The Path to Florida. Several people who served as Supreme Court clerks in 2000 broke their confidentiality agreements to speak with him about what happened behind the scenes during Bush v. Gore. Justice Stevens wrote in his dissenting opinion, "Although we may never know with complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election, the identity of the loser is perfectly clear. It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law." I asked David Margalek what he learned about how the justices in the majority reacted to what Justice Stevens wrote.
And there were memos from both Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy accusing the minority, the dissenters in the case, of disparaging the court, of trashing the court, of writing sort of hyperbolic rhetoric that would come back to hurt the Supreme Court, all under the guise of protecting the Supreme Court. I mean, very unusual rhetoric to come from one justice to another.
Now, you wrote that Justice Ginsburg included a footnote in her opinion about the African Americans in Florida who were stripped of their right to vote. And Justice Scalia, you say, asked Justice Ginsburg to delete that from her opinion, and she agreed to do it. Is this information that the clerks gave you?
This is information that the clerks gave me, and I think it's a very interesting story because you know, the public at large knew that there was a large racial dimension to what had happened in Florida. And, you know, there were all of these stories circulating already about the disenfranchisement of black voters and voters being turned away and roadblocks and all of this. I mean, if ever there was an equal protection concern, that was it. That something as important as that was, first of all, relegated to a footnote, and that that footnote was the only reference to race in any of the court's opinions. And whereupon Scalia sent a memo to criticize in his memo criticizing the tone of some of the dissents. He referred to Ginsburg's footnote as her Al Sharpton footnote. I mean, really, you know, sort of an acidic way of describing a very real problem in Florida and sort of moving it into the realm of demagoguery. And Ginsburg just sort of meekly removed the footnote from her opinion, and thereby cut out the only reference to race in any of the decisions. And I think that some of the clerks were very disappointed with that.
If this presidential election ends up in the courts, what aspect of the Supreme Court decision from 2000 might apply or, you know, have some sway this year?
Well, I suppose it would only be the, you know, in some kind of equal protection argument. The court, by injecting equal protection into electoral procedures in a way that it never had before, it opens up an avenue towards, you know, innumerable challenges to voting procedures all over the country. And this is what happens when the court sort of expends its authority profligately, as it did here. It's just an invitation to trouble because the courts have generally wanted to stay away from all of this. And even though the Supreme Court specifically said, rather lamely said, that this case applies only in this instance, that's not the way that lawyers and litigants are going to read it. And if this election is close, my personal feeling is that it won't be. But even if it is, and even if it's not as close as it was the last time, the doctrine is out there and it's available for lawyers, and lawyers are going to use it, and it could be very messy.
How do you think it could be used?
Well, you know, voting is messy. You know, I suppose it could be used in connection with voting machines. I mean, it could be used in connections with different kinds of ballots. There are just any number of ways in which the procedures in one county are different from the procedures in another. And in every one of those instances now, one could raise an equal protection claim.
Well, we learned this week that Chief Justice Rehnquist has thyroid cancer. He had a tracheotomy this week. He's 80. And there's a lot of speculation now about how long he will remain in the Supreme Court. Here's what I've been wondering. If President Bush lost the election to John Kerry, but if Justice Rehnquist left before John Kerry was sworn in, and this is all hypothetical, would President Bush still have the authority to appoint a successor? And if John Kerry didn't like that successor, would John Kerry have any power to change it? Like, what would that process be? I'm just doing a lot of hypotheticals and playing this out because I think it's a very unusual situation that we might be in.
You know, I think that it's an unlikely situation. I mean, even had there been a vacancy a year ago, it would have been very difficult, depending on whom Bush would have named, for Bush to get a replacement. I mean, there's a certain paralysis that sets in even before an election, and that paralysis would be total after an election. And so there's absolutely no way that Bush could name any kind of interim replacement and get him confirmed. I think another interesting dimension to Bush v. Gore, and the Rehnquist matter is related to this, is that many people feel that several of the justices, Rehnquist among them, O'Connor also, had wanted to quit after Bush was elected. They wanted to resign during this last presidential term, but they felt that it would have looked improper for them to do it because it would have looked like a quid pro quo, that Bush would have gotten the chance to pick their successors. And so therefore, another kind of paralysis set in over the last 4 years, and the court remained in place and its membership remained intact. I mean, as Ron Klain, Vice President Gore's former chief of staff, put it, by ruling in the majority as they did, the five justices sort of sentenced themselves to 4 more years on the Supreme Court.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
David Margalek is one of the authors of the article, The Path to Florida, published in the October issue of Vanity Fair.